This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Our guest today is Patrick Jackson, speaking on the impact of growth on the Monadnock region. The Lyceum is a series of cultural events originated 158 years ago at the Unitarian Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. Each Sunday morning at 11 during July and August, the Lyceum presents noted persons of accomplishment and distinction. Future programs this season will introduce South African political activist Ernest F. Dubé, Dr. Sidney Alexander of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Authority on Women's Affairs Alice H. Cook. You are invited to attend these programs held at the Unitarian Church in downtown Peterborough and to meet our guests at receptions following the programs. There is no admission charge. Our guest today will be introduced by Philip DuBois.
Good morning and welcome to the Monadnock Lyceum. This past year has been a traumatic one for many communities in the Monadnock region. There's been a sudden and very rapid rise in the pressure for increased subdivision and development in practically every town of the region. The two largest towns, Peterborough and Jaffrey, have each imposed a one-year moratorium on major subdivisions and are embarked on reevaluations and updatings of master plans and ordinance to protect those very qualities, tangible and intangible, that make the Monadnock region such a desirable place in which to live. It is therefore particularly appropriate in this ambience to have as our speaker this morning, Pat Jackson, who will speak on the impact of growth on the Monadnock region. Many of us here know Pat well and have worked with him on a great variety of projects. Pat has his own firm of Jackson, Jackson & Wagner of Epping, New Hampshire, which has been doing public relations counseling for the last 30 years. He is a past president of the Public Relations Society of America. He has written many articles and given many seminars to professional groups in his field, both in this country and abroad. He has taught at Boston University, University of New Hampshire, New England College, and Bowdoin College, as well as lecturing at universities across the United States. He is also a trustee of Antioch University. As you can see, Pat has had a distinguished professional career, but as New Hampshire citizens, we can all be very grateful for the fact that Pat, over the years, has brought a professional expertise and wisdom to public service. He has served on four different commissions under four different governors, King, Peterson, Thompson, and Gallen, dealing with such issues as vocational rehabilitation, state government operations, growth, land use and housing, and forest resources. However, those of us active in environmental affairs will always be particularly grateful to Pat for the enormous amount of important and effective work he did on behalf of SPACE and the Environmental Coalition. Many of us were privileged in 1982 to attend a statewide testimonial dinner given for Pat to honor, quote, his contributions to the quality of life in New England. In addition to this, you will find Pat a most articulate and charismatic speaker, and I'm most happy to present to you Pat Jackson.
Thank you, Phil. It may be an interesting way to start my remarks to you, since Phil mentioned that I had been volunteered by four governors to say that our incumbent governor was a member for several years of the Planning Commission that I chaired. And in case you're wondering which direction planning is going in New Hampshire, you may be interested in knowing I had to gavel him down most of the time. The words that we use affect our lives, I think, more than we're willing to admit, partly perhaps because we use so many words today and so many of us are articulate in using them. But the word we're discussing today is an excellent example, in my opinion, of the true power of semantics. Because the word growth, if you'll think about it, in most of our lives has almost a totally positive effect. We talk about children growing. We talk about organizations growing in their abilities to do things. We talk about our own intellectual or emotional or capability growth. And so when we're confronted with this same word in ways that may seem negative to some of us, immediately a psychological reaction is set up that I think makes it very hard for us to deal with this. And so while I'm going to talk about growth today, I want to make it perfectly clear in the beginning, and I will use that word because it's the one we're all familiar with, But I want to make it perfectly clear in the beginning that I think the beginning of wisdom on this subject is to know the difference between growth and overweight. And there is a difference. I think it's also important, however, particularly for those of us who can see some of the negative effects of growth, to distinguish between growth and simple fear of change. Because certainly when youngsters are growing up, we know psychologically that it's their fear of that next step. And as parents and grandparents and community members, it's our fear of what they might do as they grow that causes us some sleepless nights. So I think it's important just to make this distinction, that growth is neither positive nor negative, but if we can look at it in terms of overweight on the one hand, negative, but simply fearing change on the other hand, which is probably an overreaction, maybe we can come to some central position. I have been dealing with this subject for a long time, and my first thought on it is that wouldn't it be fine if human understanding or human wisdom grew as fast as human population? I'm sure you know we've just passed our 5 billionth citizen of planet Earth, and that ought to give all of us, I should think, significant pause. Wouldn't it also be uplifting if human caring spread across the landscape as rapidly as human habitation? Well, there is one thing that is actually growing faster than our numbers, and that is the sum total of man's body of knowledge. The experts tell us that now what we know doubles every 8 years. So, by the way, the next time you criticize the local public school system, you might just remember those teachers have rather a challenge, somewhat akin perhaps to the one all of us face in dealing with the growth of our community. Of course, this knowledge is basically details. It's facts about life on our planet. It's science. Nonetheless, we have built an investigatory mechanism of immense proportions. After all, we call our current era the knowledge age. And without any contradiction, I think that is certainly the case. If you'll just compare the advances in health, in space technology, in metals and materials, and in so many other areas, you can begin to understand that the data about doubling every 8 years is undoubtedly correct. But there's a problem here, a problem perhaps best illustrated by a French philosopher in 1965 who was taking a look at the coming of the knowledge era and then looking at the problems of the world. And he said this. He said, until now, the problems of mankind have been ones of nature, but from now on, the problems of mankind are going to be ones of human nature. That balance between nature and human nature, and if you'll stop to think about it, all of our knowledge explosion is only beginning to look into human nature. We're looking into the physical, we're looking into the scientific, the biological, but we're not doing very much in looking into human nature. And that's the subject I particularly want to address your attention to today, because I think if we're going to deal with growth, that is where we're going to have to deal with it. Furthermore, at the moment, we live in an era where entrepreneurship, doing it yourself, making more money, being more efficient, are highly praised. Well, you don't have to be a great student of human history to know that this move back towards independence in a world which cries out for human interdependence is at least partly a step backward. Obviously, there is a difference between self-reliance, which could be a characteristic of entrepreneurship, but basically, I think that's not what we've been talking about. We've been talking about the good old cowboy American who thinks his or her own thoughts and acts in his or her own way, that great myth, because the facts are Americans don't act like that at all. Americans, more than any other society in the world, are more prone to peer pressure, to wanting to do things the way the rest of us do. And yet this myth of the cowboy, this myth of independence, I think makes it more difficult for us to deal with the subject of growth, because it tells us you can do whatever you want to, the community be damned. It's the individual that is supreme. So this question of independence versus interdependence is one we also have to take a look at. Well, let's do that. Let's take a look. What do we know from this explosion of knowledge or from these current political trends that will help us to deal with the phenomenon of growth? First of all, I think we know for sure that a region like the Monadnock region, a community, even an individual organization, is really the sum total of its relationships. So when we think about the region, no matter how else we think about it, ultimately we're forced to recognize that all we're talking about is a group of people who have decided to live here together. And somehow this question of relationships isn't the one that we emphasize when we talk about growth. So perhaps if we're willing to do that, this will give us a body of knowledge we can call upon to use for this purpose. Secondly, it isn't the facts of growth, in my experience, that really matter. What matters is our perceptions of that growth, so that our friends from the far western states laugh when we tell them about, oh, New Hampshire is growing, my goodness, let me quote you these numbers. And of course, they laugh because they have whole cities that have grown more than our state. And yet our perceptions are the ones we have to live with, are the ones that guide our lives. And so maybe we can forget a little bit all that factual knowledge that we're always quoting, and instead look at this from a more human point of view. If relationships are what make a community, then it seems to me we need to emphasize this perceptual base, this human approach to growth, if we're going to deal with it in any way. The problem is most of us are somewhat uncomfortable with perceptions. I don't know why that should be, but I find this in my work all across North America. Probably because we're all brought up to think that rationality and logic are the important things in this world. We are, after all, trained that way in our schooling, and yet it's interesting when you look at your own life. Very few of us make logical decisions. And certainly on the important issues of our lives, we wouldn't think of making a logical decision. If you have a spouse, a special friend, whatever we call them these days, if you have one of those creatures in your lives, a significant other, you know, just ask yourself a few questions about that. This is probably the most important decision that we will ever make, because clearly it's that person with whom we spend our time, have our families, and so forth. But despite enshrining the idea of logical decisions, is there anyone here that would tell me that they chose their mate logically? I mean, what did you do? A force field analysis, perhaps? You drew a decision tree, maybe? You plugged it into the computer and said, gee, do you think this is the way I ought to go? We don't do that, do we? No, we use an illogical, perceptual, relationship decision-making system on the really important decisions in our lives. Now, if it's important there, it seems to me there's some application of that to community situations like growth, and I'm going to suggest some ways that we may be able to plug it in. This whole question of perception is one we cannot avoid. We must not avoid. In San Francisco, for example, the perceptions are changing a little bit about growth. For the last 8 years, they've had a tremendous fight over whether or not they should have any more high-rise buildings. And all of a sudden this year, the development industry has decided that it will no longer fight the current ballot initiative to limit high-rise buildings. Now, there's a reason for this, because their perceptions to start with were wrong. They thought that there would be renters for all of that space. Now that their economic perception is that they've got a third of the space empty, and their banker is calling them asking to pay the loan, somehow these perceptions have changed. But it is interesting. It is interesting that the database has not changed a bit. All the data remains the same. The only thing that has changed is people's perception of that growth based on their current experience. The trouble with perceptions, of course, is that they're very personal and very localized. And that makes them difficult to deal with. There's the wonderful story, which may help you get a better handle on what I mean by perception and how local they are, about the Premier of France, Mr. Mitterrand, when he was elected, decided he should tour the world and find out what was going on. And so he did, and he came to Washington, and he walked into Ronnie's office, and He was amazed that on Ronnie's desk there were three telephones. There was a red one, a white one, and a blue one. He thought that was quite patriotic, and so he asked the president, why do you have these? And Ronnie said, well, the red one is my hotline to Moscow, the white one is to call Nancy, and the blue one is to talk to God. Well, of course, Mitterrand, a good religious person, always had wanted to talk to God, so he said, may I use your phone? Go ahead, be my guest. So he did, and he talked for about 15 minutes, and when he was through, he thanked the president profusely, and he said, that was really wonderful, Ron. What'll it cost? Well, Ron got out his pocket calculator, and he toted it up, and he said, that'll be $215.60. So Mitterrand paid and went on about his tour, and about 4 months later, he showed up in Tel Aviv. And Menachem Begin was the premier there at that time, and he walked into Begin's office, and lo and behold, a red, white, and blue phone, and those aren't even the national colors in Israel. So, of course, he didn't want to say anything about this or let on. He thought it might be some collusion or some pact here. So he said, that's interesting. What are the phones for? And Begin said, well, you know, the red one's my hotline to Washington, the white one's to call my wife, and the blue one's to talk to God. Wonderful, says the premier. I've always wanted to talk to God. May I use your phone? Sure, go right ahead. So he did, and he was very careful, only to talk for 15 minutes. And when he was finished, he hung up. He said, that was wonderful. I've always wanted to do that. What'll it cost? And without blinking an eye, Begin said, that'll be 10 cents. At this point, Mitterrand couldn't stand it anymore, and he said, wait a minute. I have to tell you that Ronnie has these same three phones, and I called God there for 15 minutes and it cost me $215. What's the difference? And Begin said, but you have to remember that here, it's a local call. It's a good story, but it illustrates the point. Perceptions are very personal things, and so therefore, if we want to deal with growth in a community which is primarily relationships, we have to remember that we're dealing with individual people's perceptions, and we have to find a way to string those perceptions together, otherwise we are just wasting our time. How do you get this kind of consensus? Well, it's difficult, there's no question. We know that. We all go to town meeting. We know how difficult consensus is. By the same token, we have some starters. Maybe the first thing is to put this whole question of growth into some kind of an easily understandable context. And probably the best way is the standard planning technique for organizations or communities of looking at the four systems that constitute any organization. First of all, there's an economic system. Secondly, there's a technical system. Thirdly, there's a social system. And fourthly, there's a political system. And whether we're talking about the church in which we're sitting as an organization, or the community, or the region, or the nation, those four systems are always at work. It seems to me that in talking about growth, however, we tend to emphasize only two of those systems. We talk a lot about the technical system. For example, our perceptions tend to focus on the man-made environment. We see the new development. We see the new shopping center. We see the new highway. All of those physical things, buildings, if you will. And sometimes we note, for example, that long-standing or historic structures are being eliminated. And we ask ourselves, perceptually, not only should something new go there, but deeper questions like, can a person living today buy and sell the history that went with a structure that was built maybe 200 years ago? And so perceptions come in a new way, but still they're dealing with the technical issues. And of course, if you go to Boston and you walk through Copley Square, you notice the man-made effect of the wind tunnel, because while it's perfectly calm down the street, it's very windy around all those tall buildings, because they're drawing that wind down to us. And so if you talk about growth there, that's what people are apt to answer you with. And then, of course, we talk about highways. And some of us say, golly, they're not so safe. They're full of accidents. And others say, yes, but isn't it wonderful? I can get there quicker. We talk about the landscape. And the perception there that seems to be strongest is the view plane. What can I see out my window? As long as I can still see the trees and the fields out my window, somehow my perceptions of the negative impacts of growth aren't quite so bad. But if in my car, I have to drive past a lot of things that don't please me, then my perceptions of growth can be pretty negative. And isn't that really where we tend to concentrate? On the technical system of growth? Or if not, then we talk about the economic system. We talk about maybe getting in on the profits. All this money is being made and growth, and gee whiz, maybe I can sell the farm and get in on some of this and retire a little earlier or have that new whatever it is I want. And then others of us ask, yes, but exactly who benefits from this growth? Exactly who is pushing this? Who is the one that's going to end up with the profits? And doesn't that mean somebody else is going to end up with some costs, or perhaps even with a loss, even monetarily, to say nothing of other kinds of losses? Well, those are all the debates you've all had in this region for years, because that's where we concentrate, on the economic and on the technical. And I'd like to skip over those two systems and go to what I think is the heart of it. The heart of the growth issue, the opportunity in the growth issue, is in the other two systems. It's in the social system, and it's in the political system. Because those first two systems essentially are factual. You can find out who's benefiting and who's not. You can find out the exact costs. You can find out the density of population and the number of schoolrooms that are needed and what the accident rate is on the highways. And all of us should be able to do that or have it done for us by public servants or by research organizations relatively quickly and cleanly. The thing no one else can do for us is to deal with growth in the social system and through the political system. In fact, the other reason that I want to talk about these two is that I believe the two most damaging effects of growth, the two impacts that really can be damaging, come from those systems. In the political system, it is changes in the voter makeup and in voter decisions. I vote in Epping, where, as in all good New Hampshire towns, town meeting is the favorite winter sport. We start preparing for it in November, as you do. You know all about that. I get my little 3x5 cards ready, and I know who's going to take what position on what issues, and I'm all set by the time of the meeting, and that's part of the tradition. You know, it really shakes me up now to go to town meeting and to realize that half of those people I wrote the 3x5 cards for don't live in Epping anymore, and a bunch of people do live there who last year were pushing buttons or pulling levers to vote in some suburb of a large city to the south. So that when we start talking now, the value systems that we're discussing are totally different value systems. And I ask myself, if a community is indeed a group of people who have purposefully come together to share their lives and to live together, is Epping still a community? Is any town still a community when the voter base changes to the effect that indeed the value system, the relationships change? We're all familiar with the community in Oregon that was taken over by the Eastern sect and of the tremendous impact. Maybe we should read that history a little more carefully, because while nothing like that, I trust, will happen to any Monadnock towns, the constant change of folks with a different perception of what a community is an impact from which we may indeed never recover. That's one of the impacts politically that I think we must be most conscious of. The social impact that my work and my colleagues' work across the country indicates is most damaging is the crime that inevitably comes with growth. Now, if you ask police experts or the Justice Department research unit, they will tell you that crime does not inevitably come with growth. It's just that the numbers go up because there are more people there. As a sociologist, I don't believe that for a minute. I believe, indeed, that crime is committed far less often. It is far less likely to occur when I know my neighbors and my neighbors know me. When someone drives down the road and they know that that's the Joneses and that's the Johnsonses, you know, you truly have to be out of your mind. You have to be suffering from some actual mental destability in order to commit a crime under those circumstances. What growth does, of course, is to put a whole lot of people into the picture that don't know the other folks, and therefore maybe don't have quite that sense about my goods and your goods, about my perceptions of ownership and your perceptions of ownership. Well, you can agree or disagree with my postulation, but my experience is that it's the change in the political value system and the way politics functions, and it's the possible impact of crime and the tremendous social fear that comes with that, that are the things we really have to be careful of. How then can we deal with these political and social problems and turn them into political and social opportunities? Eliminate the problems and use the political and social systems to deal with the subject of growth. I think there are a number of ways that we can do it. I was recently in Stamford, Connecticut, dealing with the school board there, which has a growth-induced problem. Stamford used to be a working person's town with a few executives living on the edge who commuted into New York. Now, through the political change and the social change of growth, Stamford is a city whose school district has essentially two classes, students who need remedial work and students who need special, extra, gifted scholar education. There don't seem to be any normal students in the city anymore. And so they asked our public relations firm to find out how to deal with this. So we went down to deal with it. Incidentally, Stamford is not a bad example, perhaps, for this region, for Peterborough at least. Stamford is probably in a similar relationship to New York City as you are here to Nashua and Manchester. The numbers are a little different. But I suggest to you the change that would occur might be somewhat similar, though I trust your school system will never quite get like theirs, which is unique in the United States. When I was there, an interesting thing happened. The local Unitarian minister has gotten himself elected to the school board. Well, he's sorry now, but it's too late. And anyway, he got himself on the school board. And so he attends our training planning sessions. And at the last one, he brought me a book. He said, I think you ought to read this book because it tends to reinforce some of the things that you're saying, and maybe you ought to pass it on to others whom you meet. And I'd like to do that. The title of the book is Habits of the Heart. You may or may not have heard of it. It's now becoming a bestseller out west, I'm told. It's basically a sociological study of present-day America. The reason I recommend it to you, however, is that the book postulates that this me generation, we are all concerned about because of their numbers, is now undergoing a tremendous change and is not only becoming the we generation, but is seeking avidly for a sense of belonging, a sense of belonging. Now, as I look at the technical data about who's moving into regions like Monadnock, I find that the largest single group are folks who were in that me generation, that age group, and are now maybe moving into this we generation. And it may be that this book, if it's correct, is starting to give us a hint on how we can deal in the social and political systems with these people who are perhaps about to be our neighbors. There are really only two strategies to deal with growth. We can try to control it, or we can try to manage it. And interestingly enough, the mechanism for doing both is exactly the same. First, we have to apply the rules of relationships, because communities are relationships either way, whether we want to stop the growth or tone it down or span it out, that's really a question of community relationships. If we want to manage the growth, to admit that there's going to be some, we need to do the same thing. We need to apply those rules of community relationships. And then we need to organize structures to do so. Now, our communities are highly organized at the moment, but I cannot find any examples of the kind of organization that I'm talking about, because I think there are two types of structures we can organize that can really enable us to deal with growth, to deal with relationships and people's perceptions around it, and whether we're trying to control it or manage it. The first, I believe we need to organize some kind of a regional network to integrate newcomers. It's one thing to stand at the drugstore and go "Hrumph!" at all those folks you didn't see last week. That's right, I do it too. It's the great New Hampshire sport in the southern part of the state. But I'm starting to get a little tired of "Hrumphing." And so I took a look at the organizations that we work with, and I asked myself, what do you do in a corporate organization, when you have a lot of new people coming in that have just been hired? What do you do with them? Well, of course, what you do with them is you have an orientation session. You find out who they are, and you call them all together, and you get the leaders of the existing community together, and you say, now look, this is the value system here. This is the history of this place. These are the great benefits, the wonderful things about being here. Why can't we put newcomers into the Monadnock region through that kind of an orientation? We know who they are, or we can certainly find out quickly enough. At the moment, we leave this to our other structures. The church may do it, perhaps when the kids get to school, or when the parents finally come to school to check up on the kids, that will do it. I don't think we can leave it to that kind of chance. I think we need a super neighborhood association network right here, because there's something we have learned about this idea of orientation. And that is that people, when they make a change, go to a new job, move to a new area, are a little bit at sea. After all, it's the same cause of crime. People are at sea and they do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do. Now, if we can grab those people while they are a little bit at sea and inculcate the values of the Monadnock system into them, I think we can make a change. It's being done in other organizations all over the world. If you have children going to college, what do? The first thing they do is they try and get your youngster, and then get you, if they can, to come to campus for an orientation so they can tell you about the wonders of the place and higher education, how good it is and what the value system is. And it makes all the difference if we go through that kind of orientation. Why can't we do it here? Not only that, we've done so much work in this in organizations that we know the four things that you have to show people when they're coming into an area. The way we get across our value systems and get these people to start buying into them, to owning them as their own, is first of all, we have to tell them who our heroes are. Who are the heroes in this region? Who are the people who shaped it? The names that everybody knows. And then we need to point out some living role models. Who are the people here that really exemplify the values? So that if I just moved in here, I don't have to take your word for what the values are. I can go seek out Joe or Susie or whomever and observe them in their daily life, and then I begin to get a feel, oh, this is what living in the Monadnock region is really about, because there it is being lived out for me. And rituals, my goodness, don't we need rituals in our lives? Well, let's set up some rituals. In New York City, those areas which have neighborhood associations and monthly block parties report crime rates significantly reduced from those areas that have not got this kind of relationship organization. I think it might work here. And finally, and perhaps most potent of all, this kind of culture is passed on by some good stories. The memorable kind of thing you can write back to the folks that used to be your neighbors before you moved up here and say, boy, you know, they have this wonderful story they tell here in Jaffrey, and you share it back home and already notice what's happened. Those people now own the culture so much that they're starting to beam it out to others. I've looked and looked, and I can't find anything in a formal, network, organized way that we're doing to orient these new people. If anything, I think we tend to just kind of push them out, wish they weren't here, with also fully predictable results. Then they set about changing our political system, and they may give us some social frights. So that's something that perhaps we ought to think about. Secondly, it seems to me we can control our growth a bit, but we've learned that it's very hard through the existing political system. We have to keep trying. Goodness, we have to keep trying. And the type of organization I've just suggested, I have a hunch, might turn out to be a potent political force once everybody knew what the values were and accepted them. But it seems to me that we could learn something from the prevailing entrepreneurial thrust in our country, and that we can start thinking about some private land trusts. I personally am convinced that the private land trust, where a group of citizens or perhaps a whole community gets together with their own funds, buys those properties that they think are critical to the local landscape, and then perhaps sells off a corner, 3 lots instead of 300 lots in order to pay for the costs. It's a compromise, you bet. But if there's one thing I believe we've learned, it's that there is no solution to the growth problem without some compromise. The world is growing. People are better educated. People are economically more capable, and they are going to want to be mobile. And our ability to put our thumb in the dike for that, I have concluded, after years and years of working on this problem across North America, our ability to do that probably doesn't exist. So, supposing a group of people in my neighborhood got together and bought the last remaining farm, or perhaps we start out with an option on it. And when that farm finally has to come on the market, instead of being purchased by someone who's going to develop the 100 acres into 100 or 50 houses, supposing we buy it and maybe sell off 6 or 8 lots, whatever the number is on the edge, just to pay the costs and then dedicate the rest of the land to some kind of permanent open space. This idea has been tested and proven in New England. It is now being touted on a statewide basis in New Hampshire. I think it will work, and notice how it works. It works because a group of people share a perception about growth in their part of town, or a whole town might share a perception about growth and set up a community-wide land trust. And then, through the relationships that these people have with one another, they go forward into unified effort. Now, why is this different than what we're doing now? The reason it's different than what we're doing now is that unless there's been a sea change that I haven't noticed, most of what we're doing now is splitting into two camps. And this camp sends rockets over to this camp, and this camp sends rockets over to this camp, and the result is there's a kind of a no man's land in the middle where most of those rockets land because we don't seem to hit each other very often. My question is, how can we, either to control growth or to manage it, find some mutual relationship mechanisms that will let us do it? And I think the ones that I have suggested will work. In fact, there are 3 reasons that I know they will work. First of all, when you start dealing with people on a one-on-one basis and you start building relationships, you start inculcating the values of the community in the most powerful way possible. And that is by linking the existing traditions and values to social rewards and punishments. In short, it is socially rewarding to adopt the values of the Monadnock region, and it is socially punishing not to adopt them. We may or may not like that concept, but the sociological evidence is overwhelming that that's the way society works. Why not then make it a social reward to believe in the Monadnock region in the way that we have always believed in it, to keep those values going? The only way we're going to do it is by orienting newcomers to these values, because believe you me, they do not know them. They probably have a hunch. Some of them may have been what attracted them. But that's a lot different than having them spelled out for you by people with whom you build relationships. Secondly, there's been a lot of work done recently by scholars and practitioners on how do we mold societal behavior? How indeed can we persuade a whole community, a whole region, that indeed there's a certain path to tread? And what we know is that there are 3 steps in this process of getting consensus. The first is problem identification. We have to see to it that everybody identifies the problem the same way. And you can see that if we have an orientation organization, or if we have a land trust, we now have the capability of identifying that process, that problem, that opportunity within a relatively small group. Have you ever tried to identify a problem at town meeting and get everybody to agree, yeah, that's it, right, that's it? If you have, you've had a lot better luck than I have. The second step is personifying the problem, making sure that everybody understands that the problem affects them. And I don't think it's any surprise to anyone in this room to know that there are still a lot of people, if you talk about growth in the Monadnock region, will say, so what? They are, as the sociologists say, ignorant and apathetic. And if you ask them about it, they'll say, I don't know and I don't care. And I think we need to get some problem personification. How are we going to do that? The only way we're going to do that is in these one-on-one action organizations. The larger political system simply won't do it. Thirdly, most attempts at gaining consensus for action in a community fail because we are unable to remove people's constraints to action. In other words, we are unable to show people that they can do something about it. If we now feel that we are unable to deal with growth because we can't do anything about it, I tried to move town meeting, I tried to organize a vote, I tried to save this or to do that, then let's bring this down to action units that are small enough that we can control them. And I suggest that a network of community-type organizations that truly seek out every newcomer and orient them to our values, build relationships with them at the start, is a way we can control it. Everybody can take part in that. Everybody can do it, and land trusts are similar. What I'm really talking about is that we're going to mitigate the impacts of growth when we stop seeing it as a factual, technical, economic thing, and when we start seeing it in a social, political context based on relationships and perceptions. In other words, when we realize we are talking about the basic issues of human nature. It is human nature to want to move today, to want to do better things for your family. And if the Monadnock region looks like a place to do that, we know some people are going to come here and they're going to do it. The evidence is overwhelming that people ultimately are going to act on their human nature. This leaves those of us here to deal with the impact with a very difficult choice. We can either be absolutely resistive and say no, and the evidence is everywhere that this won't work, or we can say, look, there are going to be some compromises, and we are going to manage those compromises because they're part of human nature, and we're going to manage them in a human nature way. After all, growth on the bottom line is people. It's the people that are coming into this region. Now, if you want to deal with people, how do you do it effectively? You do it effectively by treating them respectfully as people and by setting up the mechanisms that quickly integrate them into your value system instead of letting them bring their own new value system. I think we can do it, but I want to leave you with a definition of human nature that will remind us all that while, yes, we can manage growth, and yes, to some extent, we can control it, that on the bottom line, we have to remember that this is basically a chance for us to use our human nature, and human nature is never 100% this way or 100% that way. It's always a matter of some ground in the middle where everyone benefits a little bit. I hope this story will reinforce in your minds, as I close, what I mean by that kind of human nature. I was giving a talk at Glassboro University in New Jersey not long ago, and it was a luncheon speech, and so I went into the men's room before lunch to wash my hands, and instead of one of those good old all-American paper towel racks in this restroom, they had one of those awful machines, you know, that blows hot air at you, you know the kind? I'm sure it's a communist or some kind of conspiracy. But on that machine was an instruction plate. And this instruction plate, to me, was a wonderful definition of the kind of human nature that you have to be able to practice to deal with tough problems of relationships like growth. This is what the instruction plate says. It says, one, shake excess water from hands. Two, push button to operate machine. Three, wipe hands lightly under warm airflow until dry. Well, someone who understood how the machine really worked had been there before me and had scratched on the definition of human nature. Four, wipe hands on pants. Thank you.